And then we got some ground to cover today, as always. Let's see what we can do.
There was a point we were ahead.
We're still ahead. Just trying to stay on pace. We're going to boogie today. So Kevin's going to need to put on a seatbelt. 13-4. Have we done this one?
Probably.
Yes? Oh, you're just throwing it out. Probably. You little faith, Dan. There's a lot of Proverbs. 13-4. It looks familiar. We'll skip it. Yes, no, maybe. Any of you know? Allison says no. I'm going with Allison. 13-4.
The soul of the sluggard craves in vain, but the diligent soul is amply satisfied.
Great proverb. Talks about the difference between the sluggard and the diligent. What's the difference? The soul of the sluggard craves and gets... Diana, what did yours say? In vain. Mine says it gets nothing. What does it mean to crave in vain? Does a sluggard have desires, aspirations, wants, dreams, hopes? Yes. Just like the diligent in part B. The soul of the diligent is made fat. What does that mean? What's the difference between these two? It's not the lack of desire or ambitions. Both the fool and the diligent have the same desires and dreams in life, right? One lives in an ivory tower in the sky and can't put shoe leather on reality, that has all these hopes that they would love to see happen, but they live in a daydream world. The difference between those two is that the diligent is able to take those dreams and convert them into reality and say, okay, this is what I want my life to end up as. I want to look down the road and I want to sit at my funeral. And I want to know that these things are going to be said about me when I die. This is what I want my life to amount for. I want this to be said about me personally. This is what I want said to me as a dad, as a father, as a husband, professionally. This is the things that I aspire to in life. And then they have the ability to back up 40, 50, 60, 70 years and say, if that's where I want to go, then what is it going to take to get there? Man, if I want to own a business and be a gazillionaire, okay, good for you. What is it going to take to get there? Do you need a degree? Do you need to go to college? Do you need to do these things? Do you need to get into this type of business? Then what is it going to take? And can you plot that out in 5 to 10 year increments and say, okay, if at one point in my life I want to be the CEO of a business, great. Then what is it going to take to get from right there to where you currently are now, which is a poor college student? Right? Nothing wrong with that. That's where we all start. But here's where we go. So as you guys think through your life, I encourage you to think through your death. What's going to be going on at your funeral? What do you want said about you? What do you want your life to amount to? We get 70, 80 years, right? The ones after that, you know, I'm going to be soiling myself anyway. They're not worth it, right? So what are you going to do with the years that God's given you, right? What do you want ultimately to be done in your life? What aspirations do you have? What goals do you have? Do you want to run a marathon? Do you want to, job stuff, life stuff, raising kids stuff, discipling women stuff? What matters to you? What are your gifts? What are your talents? What has God given you? And what do you want to do? And then what is it going to take to get there? And the difference between someone that can and someone that can't is the difference between a fool, a sluggard, and someone who's diligent. So some of us are further along that timeline than others. That's fine. Okay, regardless of where you're at, there's still a trajectory of, man, I've got this many years left by the grace of God, and here's how I'm going to put them together. One of the hardest assignments I ever did in my residency program was that. I had to take a manila folder, open it up, and write down 80, and I was 22 at the time, and I had to fill in the blanks everywhere. What do you want to do? What do you want to be? What do you want to read? That was so hard to put that together. And my life looks completely different than what I wrote down. But that's okay, right? I was moving, and in God's graciousness, He would steer me in certain directions and say, no, not that. That's what you wanted. This is what I want. And that's fine too, okay? But what happens is you guys begin to aspire to things and move towards things. God will direct those paths, okay? So to encourage all of you guys, do that. Think through your life. Make a difference. And if it happens to be that your plan and God's plan line up, super. If it doesn't, super. But have something, okay? There's nothing worse than the feeling of spinning your wheels and being a 33-year-old living in your mom's basement playing Nintendo and, you know, drinking, you know, Jolt Colas all day or whatever hip energy drink is around now. That's do something great with your life and aspire to greatness. Ryan's laughing at me for saying Jolt. What's the drink of choice, Ryan?
No idea?
Okay. Red Bull, Monster, whatever. I can't drink those things. They give me heart attacks, so I have enough coffee as it is. So, yeah, always. All right. So, thoughts on that before we kind of jump back into, yeah, can you imagine me on a Jolt Cola right now? Bet. Yes, sir, Elliot.
Know when that's gonna come, and so as you prepare for life, man, if you don't like prepare for, like my mother and father left, and you don't prepare for your parents' death, you don't prepare for if a sister or brother die, or even your own kid if you got kids, and mm-hmm. you have to think about mm-hmm. those things. So if it mm-hmm. do happen, you'll be able to make it through without you know hurting yourself in the process.
Yeah.
And so young kids going through college, I know you want to have fun, you want to see the world and stuff, man, but you do need to prepare for unforeseen stuff, and if you don't, nobody else will do it for you. Nobody else can do it for you.
True.
So, you know, those are great words, Mike, to start your day off with, man, and I really appreciate you doing that, because now I have something to give to some other kids. I never saw it that way.
There you go. Man, I remember sitting in an office when I was 25 with a financial planner talking about my oldest kid's college. I'm like, she's 6 months old, right? Really? I need to start saving for college now? She's 14 now. It's like, oh, right? Now, luckily, we've been putting a little bit of money away, a little, but, you know, what we can. But it's amazing how stuff like that sneaks up on you. If you think, we got time. And now it's like, oh, it's here. So the reality is, in 4 years, she's gone. And she wants to go to college. So, and we'll figure that out as she gets there. Okay. But be aware. All right. Stuff sneaks up on you as well. And good to plan that. So, all right. Let me pray. Let's dive into Solomon's life. 1 Kings 3, I think, is where we left off. We got some ground to cover today. And we'll jump into the text. Well, Lord, as we investigate a much unstudied portion of your word, and we dive into the books of the Kings, and as we see this kingdom that has been united under Saul, David, and now Solomon, soon to split, and chaos that will ensue as a result of poor leadership and wicked hearts and wicked men at the helm with a few blips on the radar of godliness. Lord, would you teach us what it means to walk with you in a difficult day? Many of these kings that had to rule in this time. We're in an era very similar to ours, where godliness was not the hip thing. Following you was not acceptable. Your word and your commands and edicts and heart were not followed much as they aren't today. So Lord, would you teach us how to lead as young men and women and seasoned men and women in here that are desiring to follow hard after you. Would you give us glimpses of insight from these men and women that we'll study even today as to how to do that well and to have a life well lived as we see now the end from some of these guys and how their lives amounted to some much and some nothing. So teach us this morning, we pray. In Christ's name, amen. All right, gang. So we are in 1 Kings 3. We have seen now Solomon take the throne. We walked through the beginning of 1 Kings. David passed the baton, not reluctantly, but he did not do maybe the best job. But he got it done. He hands the baton to Solomon. We see Adonijah, ultimately one of his sons, his third-born son, tried to raise up, take the throne, and it was kind of the pressing from Bathsheba and Nathan the prophet that said, hey, man, if you want Solomon to be on the throne, you got to get it done. So David does it. We saw his death at the end of, chapter 1 or chapter 2. And then Solomon immediately hits the stage, and he's got to deal with multiple problems. He's got to deal with Joab. He's got to deal with the cursing Mooner, Sheba, or Shimei, I think is his name. Got a couple things he's got to deal with. But what do we immediately see in Solomon as he takes the throne as this young 21-year-old? Zeal. What else? Wisdom. And you're going to see that exemplified even more so this morning as you read some of his stories. Solomon, we're going to skip rocks across his life because that's how the scripture covers it. He doesn't get the depth of coverage that David does, but we're going to see kind of blips on the radar of his greatness and what makes the guy amazing. And then there's a couple things that you're going to see that you're going to go, that doesn't look good. You know, take note of that. All right. So in 1 Kings chapter 3, let's start there. 3:1. All right, so marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He gets a daughter out of this deal. Again, we talked about Solomon. 700 wives, 300 concubines. Those are the opposite. Anyway, it's a grip. This is one of them. Now, he already has a previous marriage. He already has a kid. Well, a kid's coming. Doesn't have a kid yet. But he's got a kid that's coming from a previous marriage than this. So this is not his first wife. But we're already seeing him try to make alliances. Solomon is in the power position with the king of Egypt at this point, but he's trying to make sure that they are hunky-dory, if you will, and that peace will be on his borders. And this is one of those things that ultimately helps that, all right? Now, verse 2, watch what's going on, condition of the land, in terms of how the folks are worshiping without the tabernacle. All right, we've seen that before. What's the idea of the high places? Where are those from? Yeah, they're idols primarily. Now, this isn't negative here, but the idea is with David taking the ark and bringing it into Jerusalem, with the tabernacle in a Gibeonite city, Gibeon, we'll see that mentioned today, they're separated. So they lack kind of a central place to worship. Now, Solomon would still go to Gibeon. He would offer sacrifices, but the people would find the high places and worship there. Not worship other gods, but worship Yahweh. So this was kind of part and parcel for the day, okay? We see in verse 4, the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there because that's, again, where the tabernacle is at that point. And Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on the altar. You're going to see some numbers with this guy that are going to blow your mind in terms of how much stuff he has, the wealth, the prosperity, and even the type of king he is, right? So as Solomon is there one time offering to God and praying, God shows up in verse 5, and this is his... This is his request of Solomon. This is amazing. Verse 5.
By Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. God said, "Ask what I shall give you."
Can you imagine? God says, "Solomon, here's a blank check. You fill it out. Whatever you ask, I will give it to you." You're a 21-year-old male. You have the most powerful nation in the world currently. What are you asking for? Dear Lord, thank you that I was not in that position, right? Here's what Solomon asked for. Look at verse 6 and following.
Then Solomon said, "You have shown great loving kindness to your servant David, my father, according as he walked before you in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart toward you. And you have reserved for him this great loving kindness, that you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day."
That's great. God, you were great to my dad because I'm living in the wake of his godliness. I get to be on the throne. I did nothing to deserve this. Thank you. Now, Lord, you have made your servant in the king of place of David. However, I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or how to come in. What is Solomon saying? Man, I'm nothing. And I don't have the first clue how to lead this kingdom. Now, is that the case? Is this a pretty wise young man? Absolutely. David saw that in him, one of the reasons he put him on the throne. But he's saying, as I'm looking out there, look at verse 8. "Your servant is in the midst of your people, which you have chosen are too great to be numbered." I'm not going to take a census like my dad did because that didn't go well. But there's a grip of people. So verse 9, here's what I'm asking for.
"Give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, to who is able to judge this great people of yours?
Man, if you're God, what are you thinking right now? Like, come on. Attaboy, Solomon. You could ask for money, for women, for fame, for all the things a 21-year-old male may ask for, and you didn't. And God says, man, it was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon asked these things. And God says, how about this? Because you have asked this thing in verse 11, have not asked for yourself long life, asked for riches, asked for life, the life of your enemies, but have asked for your discernment and to understand justice. I have done according to your words, and behold, I have given you, in verse 12, a wise and discerning heart, so that there will, so that there has been no one like you, and nor shall one be like you arise after you. So, Solomon, you're going to be the wisest guy that's ever lived in human history. Not a bad thing to, you know, stamp on your tombstone when you're dead. Not only that, verse 13, I have also given you what you have not asked for. Riches, honor, and there will not be a king like you the rest of the days following you. Solomon is going to expand the land like we've never seen before. He's going to have more money than any other Israelite king in history. He's going to get money. He's going to get fame. He's going to have it all. He's going to have peace. He's going to have prosperity. The people are going to love him on level, if not even more so than King David. Amazing. So what does God do with this guy that asks out of a right heart? I'm going to give you even more than you asked for. Guys, remember that. Man, does God know what Solomon wanted? Maybe itches that he had, and he said, no, those would be very selfish of me. This is what the people need. And when he prays in a way that's unselfish, God says, man, I'm going to answer that, and I'm going to answer the desires of your heart. Okay? Those things aren't necessarily wicked, but you're gonna see that teeter-totter begin to tip with Solomon. As God continues to bless him and bless him and bless him, the foundation that he has that is the other side of that teeter-totter is not going to be able to sustain the weight of money, of fame, of success, of women, and all the things that God is going to allow him to have. And one day, it's just going to go whoop, and it's done. And Solomon's career is over, okay? So, now prior to that, watch this guy's reign. He is amazing. So, he gets all this stuff. He wakes from the dream in verse 15. They have a feast, make a covenant with the Lord. Verse 16 now, separate story. This is one that you guys have probably all heard before, and it's one of the most famous of the things that make Solomon so wise. Verse 16, pick up there and read about.
Quick question.
You bet.
It says the ark is now in Jerusalem. When did he bring it to Jerusalem?
Wow. Just about choked. Just caught me off guard, Buck. Sorry. A little emotional this morning. Wow, wrong hole. Don't go down that way. David brought it in. It's been in there for years. The tabernacle is not in Jerusalem. David brought the ark in. Okay, so ark's still in Jerusalem in David's tent. By the way, 2 Chronicles chapter 1 is very clear on David brought the ark in, left the tent in Gibeon, put his own tent on the ark and not the tabernacle. Okay, so 2 Chronicles chapter 1. Talks about that in further detail, okay? So, ark's there, tabernacle's not. All right? Two women, verse 16, two harlots come to him. 17, this is their issue.
Then the one woman said, oh, my Lord, this woman and I live in the same house. I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. Then on the third day, after I gave birth, this woman also gave birth, and we were alone. There was no one else with us in the house. Only these two were in the house. And this woman's son died in the night because she lay on him.
Whoops, that's not good. So she lays on her kid, and unfortunately the kid dies. Okay? The woman whose kid dies takes the living kid from the other mother in the middle of the night and switches him so that the living, the mom that did not lay on her kid ends up with the dead baby. The mom that did lay on her kid has the live baby. And then the mom that now has a dead baby wakes up and goes, that ain't my kid, that's my kid. And the mom says, no, it's not. That's my kid, okay? But there's no one there to witness it. There's no one there to know who's lying. And you got two newborn babies. So they come to Solomon and say, what are we supposed to do? Watch Solomon's answer, verse 24.
And the king said, bring me a sword.
So a sword was brought before the king, and the king said, divide the living children, the living child in two, and give half of the one and half to the other.
Wow. Like, not a good solution, Solomon. What is he doing? He's testing him. How so? How is the mom whose child, the birth mom, going to react to that? Man, no. Like, don't kill the kid. I'd rather the kid live and be with the other mom than to be divided in half and die. So sure enough, the woman whose child was the living spoke to the king and said, so she was deeply stirred in verse 26, oh, my Lord, give the living child, give her the living child and by no means kill him. But the other said, he shall be neither mine nor yours, divide him. Did Solomon figure out exactly what he needed to figure out? Absolutely. He says, great. The king said, give the first woman the living child and by no means kill him. She's his mother. That's what Solomon was after the whole time, but brilliance in the way that he figures it out, right? Plays them both and brings the deception to the surface so he's able to judge rightly. Now, if you've got a king like that, that has that type of discernment over a kingdom, boy, that's great. And a heart of godliness, which he does at this point to go with it, that's impressive. And that's Solomon at the beginning, okay? Chapter 4, yeah, Kevin. Chapter 4. Watch this. This is the people that he has around him to help him do just that. Okay. Solomon was king over Israel. 4:1. His officials were Azariah the priest. He's got a priest around him, right? So he brings in godliness into his kingdom. A bunch of names that aren't that important. Verse 3. Verse 4. Look who's the general of his army. Benaiah. You like that guy? Absolutely. Okay. We learned about Benaiah last week, except for Buck. Poor Buck. Azariah, the son of Nathan, was over the deputies. Who's Nathan? What did Nathan do for David? He stuck his finger in his chest and said, you're the man that sins. So who does Solomon get on his team? A truth teller, the son of Nathan. If he's anything like his dad, he's going to speak words. And it says Zabad, the son of Nathan, a priest, was the king's friend. So here's a guy in his life that's going to speak truth that is not impressed with Solomon, right? Been around the block with this kid and says, man, I know who you are, and I'm going to tell you what I think, whether you want to hear it or not. So what do you notice Solomon doing? He's getting smart guys around him, okay, that can speak into his life. One of the guys that he probably shouldn't have grabbed, but he does here in verse 6. Ahishar was over the household, and Adoram, the son of Abda, was over the men subject to forced labor. So who else does he grab on his team? Same guy David had that was over the forced labor of Israel, okay? Probably not to the degree that maybe I spoke. These aren't slaves in the purest sense of the word. They would get people from other countries to be pure slaves, but Israel had forced labor, okay? When you see some of the things that Solomon's going to aspire to build, it takes a grip of people. And they had like forced jobs to come build for Solomon. They were free. But he whipped them, so much so that when the kingdom divides, this is going to be one of the core issues, because Solomon was so hard on the people. And they're going to come to his son and say, hey, look, if you'll just downshift from fifth to third, we can live with you. But back it off a little bit. Your father whipped us, like, enough. We're done. And he says, well, we'll see what he says. But this is one of the core issues. So he continues the forced labor, okay? Verse 7, Solomon had 12 deputies over Israel who provided the king and his household, and each man had to provide a month of the year. So these guys would take care of Solomon. The other job that these 12 deputies would do would be what? Why 12 deputies in Israel? You're over a tribe. What is he setting up? Like governors. Okay, I trust you. Great. You take care of Manasseh. You take care of Ephraim. You take care of Issachar. And there, he's administrating. So, brilliant guy. He realizes, I have a huge kingdom. I can't do this all myself. I need people to help me administrate. So, all the way through verse 19, you see all the folks that are there. 20 and following, this is the condition of Israel right now. Read this.
Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines. Of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life.
Keep rolling.
Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cords of fine flour and 60 cores of meal. 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl.
That's a lot. There's a grip of stuff, as you can see. Solomon has a ton of money. Sorry, let me make this a little bit bigger. I want you to see the size of his kingdom and where he expands it to, both good and bad. Let's see here. So this is the original allotment of land that God gave. So as we read through Deuteronomy 30, as we read and think through Genesis 12, this is the allotment of land that God said, Israel, you get this, okay? This was the part when Ephraim and Manasseh said, hey, can we live on the east side of the Jordan? God said, okay, no problem. The tribes of Joseph are over here. So that's where they originally were allotted land. I want you to see what Solomon does. And by the way, keep your eye on Edom and Moab. What did God say about these countries down here? When Joshua wanted to go through that, or Moses wanted to go through, what did God say? Leave them alone. Do you get their land? No, I've given them land. These are, you know, old school cousins way back in the day from Abraham and the like, okay? So God says, you don't get those. Sorry. Let's try that. Mobetta? Okay. What did he take? Edom? Moab? Okay, the top of that map, by the way, that we just looked at, was kind of somewhere up in here. Solomon goes all the way to the Euphrates River. Now, does he take a grip of land? Yeah. He took a grip of land that God said, that's not yours to take. So he's winning battles. He's got peace. Okay. Verse 25, Judah and Israel lived in safety, every man under the vine and fig tree from Dan to Beersheba all the days of Solomon. I mean, verse 24, he had peace on all sides. We haven't seen that since David's Camelot days from 2 Samuel 5 to 11 to his sin with Bathsheba. So, but what we haven't seen is this. We haven't seen land acquisition pushed this far.
Mike, didn't God say to Abraham back in Genesis, like all the way from the Euphrates to the Great River, Nile, maybe?
I'm trying to remember the delineation. So that sounds right, but I'm just comparing on the map. I'd have to go back and look at it specifically. It seems like Solomon's pushed his borders further than maybe God had wanted, and definitely without...
But the Euphrates is way east.
Yeah, the Euphrates is here, up north, and then obviously comes back down on the Fertile Crescent. So yeah, but runs northeast, okay? So it seems like he's pushed a little bit further than he should. Now, he doesn't necessarily get his hand slapped, but just so you guys have an idea of the size of the land allotment that he took a grip, okay? Which, when you're trying to put your borders at peace, you know, and there's people attacking you, you put them down. So as a king, he's trying to administrate wisely. And at this point in his career, he seems to be doing that. And the people love him. They've got prosperity. They got food. They got everything they need. There's money in their pockets. And they have peace from their enemies. What else can you ask for a king? And our king loves Jesus. So, yeah, it's good.
Was he fighting battles like his dad David, or was he getting this land by...
It seems more so like that. He was not a man of bloodshed. Now, he's got Benaiah. He has an army. He's got naval ships that are going out. So he's certainly sending out folks. He's in Africa, by the way, we're going to see. He's up north in the Mediterranean Sea, fighting battles up in, like, Turkey up there. So he is, but he's not necessarily like his dad in that regard in terms of a more battle-hardened, seasoned type guy. But he definitely is acquiring land through treaty and through battle, okay? So that's the idea. So you with me in just the picture of kind of how God is working with him? Okay. God gave Solomon, verse 29 of chapter 4, wisdom, great discernment, breadth of mind like the sand that is on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the earth. He was wiser than all men. I mean, good gracious. Verse 32, he spoke 3,000 proverbs, like we've read 50 of them. He's got those rolling off his tongue. And, you know, we're not interpreting his. He's just actually saying them. I mean, the guy's brilliant, right? Verse 34, look at the last verse of chapter 4. Look what's said about this guy.
Solomon and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom.
That's insane. I mean, this is like the, you know, the guru up the hill in Hindu religion that goes seek the prophet. I mean, but it's real. That's Solomon. They didn't come to see his money per se. They came to see his wisdom and then everything else that came along with it. This guy has, he's got the best advice around. So that's Solomon. And the people at this point love him. So remember that. Solomon starts great. He's wholly devoted to God. Chapter 5 and following, you're going to see the outflow of that love for God. He's going to say, man, I'm going to build God a house. My dad planned it. God shut him down and said, no, you're a man of bloodshed. You don't get to build the house. David made the plans. We see through the end of 1 Chronicles, David got everything ready, preparations, blueprints, cut the wood, laid it out, got the job site, got the permits, everything required, and got it ready for Solomon and said, go. And Solomon said, absolutely, we're going to build God a house. And while I'm building God a house, I'll build myself a really fat house as well. So Solomon, he double dips a little bit to the point where he completely depletes his entire bank account doing it. So he's going to build a insane house for God and for himself, which is, I guess you're the king and you can do that. But he depletes his savings account along the way. So not good. All right. Now, chapter 5, let's move into the temple. Okay. And as a reminder, we'll get to this. All right, so we got to go back to our tabernacle days and we'll kind of work through it. So this is what we have, or this is what we had, right? Tabernacle in the wilderness, all the camps camped around it, simple, portable, all the elements of worship that are there, including the ark. We got that all the way into Jerusalem, or almost in Jerusalem. We got it into Israel. Battles started happening. Philistines took over. They stole the ark. They wigged out. Gave it back to Israel. Israel wigged out and said, we don't want it. Give it to, you know, put it in Kiriat Yearim, put it up the hill. So you guys remember the story. So we've got the ark ultimately and the tabernacle separated. Solomon's going to be the first king that says, we're going to bring them all here. We're going to take the ark. We're going to put the tabernacle of God, not David's tent, on top of it. And then we're going to build God a fat, permanent house. So regardless of your theology on it, good, bad, or indifferent, God builds or Solomon builds this great house for God. God's going to occupy it. He's cool with it. He's like, great, I'll dwell there. Like to be portable, but whatever. I'm not. So there you go.
For the tabernacle, are they still trying to sacrifice at the tabernacle because like the two were separate?
Yeah, it looks like they would go to Gibeon, and it's mentioned in here a couple times that like three times a year Solomon would go to that high place and offer sacrifices. So it was still a place of worship. There was just, it didn't have the centrality that it did before because the elements are separated. So do I go to the altar? Do I go to the ark? Do I go to the tabernacle? It got weird. So, and Solomon recognized that. These need to be united, okay? So. We don't see that mentioned. We'll see in the life of like the two kings that take over, Jeroboam is going to replicate all the festival days, or at least one of them, of Israel. He's going to make his own. So it looks like they were still around. They're just not mentioned. So you got a godly king who's making sacrifices. I would assume so. But it goes south in a hurry once they split. Okay. So chapter 5, Solomon says, man, I'm going to build the temple. And I'm not going to build any temple. I'm going to build a ridiculous temple. Solomon goes to Hiram, king of Tyre. So up north on the coast. Gets a bunch of stuff from him. This guy's got all the wood. There's no wood in Israel, by the way. There's stone everywhere. But you don't build with wood because you don't have it as a natural resource. So you've got to go north. So he makes a deal with Hiram, king of Tyre, and says, hey, you send me wood, cypress trees and the like. I need him to build my temple. Hook me up. So they've got an old friendship way back to David. Guy says, no problem. He gives him anything and everything he asks for. We're going to find out it's going to cost Solomon a little bit. He gives him like 11 cities in the Galilee as exchange for all this wood. So it ain't free. It's a nice gesture. And then Hiram kind of goes, those are lame. And then ends up paying Solomon for him. So apparently he gave him a lot. Hiram didn't like him. We'll see here in a bit. And anyway, but they're buddies at the very least. Okay. Verse 10 of chapter 5, Hiram gave Solomon as much as he desired of the cedar of the cypress timber. So he's now got wood. He's got the other natural resources that his dad has prepared for him, stone and the like. 13 and following, look at the the number of people that this takes to pull this off.
King Solomon drafted force later out of all Israel, and the number drafted 30,000 men, and he sent them to Lebanon.
Okay, this is Israelites. 30,000 Israelites get drafted to work. Okay, not slaves. We're going to see slaves in a second. These are the men that are forced to do this work, but are treated probably a little bit better. They probably had the supervising positions and such, but not to the degree that the other ones did. Okay, he sent to Lebanon 10,000 a month in relays to get the wood and bring it back down. Verse 15, here come the slaves. Solomon had 70,000 transporters, 80,000 hewers of stone in the mountain. You have 80,000 stonemasons that are cutting stone from quarries to bring down to Solomon in Jerusalem. 80,000. That's insane. He's got 70,000 there, 80,000 right there in verse 15. That's 150,000, 30,000 more, 180,000 people working on a construction project. Can you imagine trying to orchestrate that? That's insane. Your entire nation is about building two buildings, Solomon's house and God's house. And that's his goal. So when we talk about Solomon, he was a builder. So he's got things that are obviously still around. David didn't do these sorts of things, but boy, the people get ticked at Solomon because of his desire to do what he did. All right. So he's going to put the people to work. All right. 16, besides Solomon's 3,300 chief deputies who were over the project, who ruled over the people doing their own work. So then he's got another group of people that all they do is oversee. 33,000 middle managers. Okay, big. So there you go. Verse 6, Solomon starts. We get kind of the timeline here, and I'll just walk you through it here in a second. So back to the screen, if you will, just to show you a couple things. So there's the tabernacle. We've seen this before. Those are all the elements. Those elements are going to get brought into the temple for worship. Now, I think, Allison, you were asking about this. Here's the timeline, okay, as you want to know kind of what big picture has happened. The tabernacle was constructed 1 year after the Exodus. So 1446 is the conservative dating of the Exodus. That's where I stand. The tabernacle was constructed a year after that, right? In 966, that's where we're at in chapter 6, verse 1. Solomon's going to start the building in 966. He takes the throne in 971-ish. It says, I think it's here, like 4 years into his reign. So there's a maybe a year or two, you know, off, but that's kind of the idea. And it takes him 20 years to build that. Think about that. 180,000 people, and it takes him 20 years to build a building. And they can put a house up in Fresno, by the way, if the weather's good, in 3.5-4 months. A house. A 3,000 square foot, two-story house. Now, they got cranes and other stuff, but boy, that's insane. All right? As you guys know, and by the way, if you have this chart with you, bring it. You're going to need it. Bring it tomorrow for sure. Okay? That's when Solomon takes the reign at the top. Okay, we've seen that, and I'll show you. I've got this chart that I'll throw up here in a second. At the end of this, it ends with the Babylonian captivity. The northern tribes that we're going to start studying today get taken by Assyria in 721. The southern tribes of Judah get taken in 586 by Babylon. Babylon comes in 586 and ransacks everything, and they destroy Solomon's temple. Okay, deportation happens, right? Daniel, those guys, they're all living in captivity in Babylon, and the world powers change. Ultimately, Persia takes over. King of Persia says, hey, Jews, you've got the green light to go back home. And we see three returns underneath Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. We will study those books, not the book of Zerubbabel because there's not one, but he's in Ezra, and how that went down. Those guys come back, and they build the second temple. The second temple is the same footprint as Solomon's temple, but way less cool, okay? They went from Ferrari to Yugo. They built it. It works. It goes. It's just sad, okay? The old people think it's sad because they saw the other one and went, man, this is lame. The new people think, man, at least we're not living in captivity. It's cool, okay? Now, that one stays around until Herod, okay? Yeah, Kevin. I was. In 20 BC, Herod the nut job the great comes into reign. Okay, we're going to learn about Herod in Israel. Herod's crazy, and I'll give you just a brief overview of him now. Herod is in a weird spot. Rome, at this point in 20 BC, so we're fast-forwarding a lot. This is intertestamental period. Rome is in control of Israel. Herod has to make the Jews happy. It has to make Rome happy. Rome said, Herod, you can be the king of Judea. You're the king of the land of Israel, but you've got to make both of us happy. So Herod says, well, if I bring in a grip of money and give it to Rome, they'll be happy. If I make sure that this temple and the people of God can worship here, the Jews are going to be happy. So Herod says, I'm going to bling this thing out like no one's blinged it out before. I would make the argument that Herod could build even more so than Solomon could. This guy was crazy, and he built stuff that you'll see in Israel that is nuts, okay? So he builds basically the expansion plan of the second temple. He takes the second temple, moves it, rebuilds it. I'll show you that here in a second in a video, and he blings this thing out. And what we ultimately get is Solomon's temple on steroids, more or less, okay? Yes, I'll show you. He's crazy, okay? Herod does that. That process starts in 20 BC, ends in 67 AD. So as Jesus is doing ministry on the earth, they're doing the reconstruction of this temple. Herod finishes it in 67 AD, and 3 years later, the Romans come in under Titus and ransack it and destroy it. So he spends 80-plus years building this thing, and the Romans come in a few days or weeks or whatever it is and ransack it, okay? So that is the second temple destroyed by Rome, okay? Right now, when we go to Israel, you're not going to see a temple up there. You're going to see a Muslim place of worship called the Dome of the Rock in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and those are the dates for those, okay? 685, Ronan will tell you about the history of that. That's when the Dome of the Rock was constructed up there. Over the Holy of Holies site. And then in 1967, the Jews, through some battles, won Israel back over. We'll study those as we get to Israel again. And then they basically gave back the Temple Mount to the Muslims in exchange for peace. Okay, so that is why today you see a Muslim place of worship as opposed to a Jewish place of worship on top of the Temple Mount. All right, so make sense? You don't need to know this for the test. Just want you guys to have the timeline in your head, okay? Here's Solomon's temple, okay? Look like that. Impressive, large, gold. I mean, bling it out. It's insane, okay? Solomon's temple there to the left. There's Herod's temple. That is part of Herod's temple. That's like a ninth of it, right? So when Herod rebuilds it, he says, okay, let's make it taller, let's make it bigger, let's make it more impressive. And then we're on top of this mountain. So we built this building on top of a mountain. There's a valley all the way around. You can only get a very few amount of people on the top of the mountain. So let's just move the mountain and let's fill it in so that we can get a whole complex up here, the center of it being that. So this is what Herod's temple would have looked like. There's a... in Israel, we'll go here. This is the temple model. It is a two-scale, to-the-detail vision of the whole city. I'm only showing you one picture. But this is the Temple Mount proper that Herod rebuilds and adds on to, makes a court for the women, a whole other structure where Jewish women can go. And then this is what it would have looked like, the whole thing, okay? So here's Herod's temple. Herod builds all of this so that people can go worship. It's insane in terms of what it took to do that, okay? So obviously a drawing of what it probably would have looked like. That's from the southeastern side. These are the southern steps of Israel. People would have lived all around it. You would have gone up these arches. This is Robinson's Arch right here, up into the portico of Solomon. They would have festival days where you could literally get a million people up there. This is like, I think it's like 9 football fields up here. It's gigantic. I mean, insane. In Ramadan, Muslim holiday of Ramadan, I think they get a million people up there on the final day of Ramadan when they break their 40-day fast. It's crazy, okay? I lied to you. There's the city model, okay? So that's what it looks like. 5 stories. I had it in a note. Where is it? Oh, I think I minimized it. Anyway. Sorry, 15 stories. Herod's is 15 stories high. Okay. That one is 15 stories tall. Okay. So just think about, like, why? Why would you do that if you're Herod? Because you can. That's Herod. Okay. So Jews are happy, man. He gave me a place of worship. Rome's happy because Jews pay taxes and send it to Rome. Herod's going to have some fat castles. Insane. Okay. Same footprint as, the former ones, but way cooler. All right. So showed you that. Now.
Mike,
yes.
Is this no longer on the same temple or on the same mountaintop that Abraham sacrificed
at? We're in the exact same place.
Okay.
Okay. Now, here's how Herod did it.
Welcome to the Western Wall Tunnels. My name is Yehuda. I'll be your tour guide today.
Hi, Yehuda.
Before we enter the tunnels, let's briefly walk through the history of Jerusalem. In front of us, there's a model of a mountain. This mountain is a very famous one. It's called Mount Moriah.
That's it today.
In reality, this mountain is right here behind me.
No, I don't want you. That's what you see today, okay? So when we go, this is the Dome of the Rock, okay? This is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the southern end of the temple. This is where the Holy of Holies is. This is where the temple was. This is where the Ark Room would have been. Okay, so this is kind of the area. The structure that was first built was the Dome of the Rock here. Okay. Later on, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is built on the southern end. The mosque is actually their place of worship. Only Muslims can go in there. There's some pictures on the internet, but they let very, very few non-Muslim people go in there. Okay, that is the Temple Mount today. All right.
In reality, this mountain is right here behind me. The reason you don't see this mountain today is because there was a big structure built upon it called the Temple Mount. According to Jewish tradition, right over here, the peak of the mountain is called the Foundation Stone. It's the spiritual center of the earth. Our story starts 3,000 years ago with King David, who establishes a capital here in Jerusalem. The story continues with his son, King Solomon, who builds the first temple. And after that, the second temple will be built. Our story starts in the tunnels 2,000 years ago, towards the end of the Second Temple era. A very famous king comes into power here in Jerusalem. His name is King Herod, and he wants to appear as a kind king. He wants the Jewish people to like him. So he decides to glorify the temple. He does it by digging out this hill in the north, and filling in the lower parts of the mountain with arches, and above that, a huge platform, which we know today as the Temple Mount. Right over here is the foundation stone, which above that, King Herod renovates the second temple and builds the most glorious temple ever seen. Sadly, in the year 70, a Roman general named Titus comes to Jerusalem, conquers the city, and on the 9th, the Jewish month Av destroys the Second Temple. 1,400 years ago, the Muslims built the structure we all know today in the middle of the Temple Mount, the Golden Dome, the Dome of the Rock. 700 years ago, in Jerusalem time, practically yesterday, the Mamluks come to Jerusalem. Mamluks, who are devoted Muslims, decide they want the entire citizen population should have easy access into the Temple Mount. They do not want to climb from the valley where they lived up to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and back down 5 times a day like a yo-yo. What do? In the same technique Herod used, they fill in the entire valley with arches leaning against the western wall. Arches above arches above arches. And above these arches, they built their houses. They create what we know today as the Muslim quarter in the old city. As you could see, the Muslim quarter today conceals most of the western wall, leaving us only a small portion.
Okay, so when we talk about the western wall that you see in pictures today, the only part the Jews have access to is here. Okay, so this is the place where people go to pray. All this is covered. Now, they've recently excavated underneath the Muslim quarter, and you can go walk, and we will when we go to Israel, underneath the Muslim quarter and see Herod's stones that he put in, and the rest of the wall. It's crazy. but the only open access they have is here. So when you hear about the Wailing Wall, you see all the pictures on the internet of people looking at a wall and praying and that sort of thing, this is where it happens, okay? This is available for the public, but this is kind of the holiest place because it's the closest place they have that Jews can access to what they believe is the most holy place on earth, okay? Does that make sense? Okay, so we're going to go through this tour when we go to Israel, okay? And then some. It's more so. This is the only one I could find on the internet to kind of show you guys what it looked like, okay? Jerusalem.com, by the way, is a great resource. So if you guys want to see more stuff like that, it's a great website that I've used just to kind of get information, okay? So just to give you guys a picture, wakey-wakey, that's what we're looking at, all right? So Solomon's going to build this temple, right? That's where it's all going to start. Ultimately, this is what it turns into. Herod's going to bling it out, and then Ezekiel talks about a third temple that is yet future, that's even bigger than Solomon's temple that he built, all right? So as you look through chapter 6, 7, 8, okay, in 1 Kings, these are the chapters that talk about the temple and its building, okay? There's a bit of stuff that's mentioned in here. Chapter 8 is pretty impressive in terms of, man, Solomon's prayer. He basically dedicates this temple to God. And the cool thing is, God shows up, okay? 8 verse 11, the priest could not stand to minister because of the cloud, the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. So God apparently wasn't so opposed to this idea that he won't dwell there. He dwells there, and the presence of the Lord is in Solomon's temple. But ultimately, I think we would argue that God would have preferred a simple, mobile tent as opposed to a permanent structure, okay? But at this point in Solomon's life, man, he is godly. He's seeking the Lord. He's building God a house. He's bringing back the ark. He's bringing the tabernacle. He's reunited all of those things together. So now, chapter 9, verse 10, after 20 years, the text tells us, all those things are back and now reunited. Okay? So that's what we just read. All the things I just showed you pictures of, that's where we're at. All right? So let's do this. Let's pick up in chapter 9, verse 15, and see a couple other blips of greatness on the radar for Solomon, and then we're going to see his demise. So 9, verse 15. Somebody pick up there. Gezer. How do you pronounce that city? Gezer. Okay. Somebody tell me the importance of Gezer. We learned it a long time ago. There were four cities west of Jerusalem that I said are really, really important because they guard Jerusalem. Gezer is one of them. It's a gateway city. You guys remember that conversation like in September? Gezer, Bet Shemesh, Azekah, Lachish. All right. Those cities guarded Jerusalem from the west. What does Solomon acquire during his reign from the king of Pharaoh in exchange for his wife, or his daughter, ultimately Solomon's wife? Gezer. He got that in a trade, okay? So what is Solomon doing, not just to Jerusalem, but the cities around Jerusalem? He's fortifying those cities. So he's not just building his house, he's protecting all the cities around his house. Those chariots and horses that are mentioned with Solomon. We read a couple of them already about the number of horses that he had that are insane. It talks about chariots and chariot cities to the north in Megiddo, in Armageddon, where we're going to see that battle. The city of Megiddo is what's called a chariot city. They would have housed chariots that he took from the Philistines, horses, and armies. So Solomon is making sure that at the epicenter of his kingdom, which is Jerusalem, all the cities around it are prepared to do battle, are fortified, are supplied. So he is building his empire, if you will. Okay?
I'm struggling to think of Solomon as a godly king at this point. He's got all this forced labor. He's started acquiring wives. It sounds like he's already a train wreck. He's spending money, in my mind, God's money unwisely.
I would agree. Yeah. It's just a matter of, We're gonna see it tip in 11, and we'll see what tips it. Apparently, his heart is still fully devoted to God, so he hasn't started into idolatry yet. All the other signs, hey, Solomon, don't have too many horses. Did I do that? Yep. Am I supposed to have chariots in warfare? No. Am I supposed to have too many wives? Deuteronomy 17? No. Am I supposed to have too much money? No. He's done all that. And it's not that any of those things necessarily are evil, but they're signs of what's going to come in Solomon, which is too many wives that are going to lead to what? What are a bunch of wives going to do? When you take a Philistine wife and an Egyptian wife and blah, 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 who do they worship? Other gods, okay? Do you like a peaceful household? I do. So when my wife, one of my 1,000, says, where is my altar to Chemosh? She has an altar to Ashtoreth. Where's my altar to Chemosh? Okay, let me build that, and let me build that. And to appease these women around him, he starts doing that, and then all of a sudden, his heart gets sucked in, and Solomon starts participating. And you're going to read some things about Solomon, you're going to go, are you kidding me? He's doing these things? So Scott, for what it's worth, the teeter-totter hasn't tipped, but boy, all the evidences are there that you go, boy, you do not have nobody has the depth of character to withstand that type of blessing. It's just too much, okay? So that's a good way to look at it, okay? So Gezer, he gets back there. Just a note, 922, Solomon did not make slaves of the sons of Israel, for they were men of war. He put them to work in forced labor, but he does something different with the others. So he's still kind of toeing this line. He builds in verse 24 his own house, Milo, which is next to the temple. This is where he ultimately puts Pharaoh's daughter. So this is her house that he lives in as well. Verse 25, three times a year, Solomon offered burnt offerings and peace offerings on the altar which he built to the Lord. This would have been at the temple that he's now built. 26, here's a description of Solomon's navy. Have we seen in Israel a navy ever? Solomon has one. Watch what it does. Okay, where's the Red Sea? South. So he's got a fleet of ships that go south that are conquering and leaving out of those ports in the Red Sea. Okay, keep going. 27.
And Hiram sent with the fleet of his servants, seamen, who were familiar with the sea, together with the servants of Solomon. And they went to Ophir and brought from their gold 420 talents, and they brought it to King.
420 talents of gold. Where's my note on that? It's a grip is the ultimate. Anyway, so Solomon is acquiring, 15.75 tons of gold. Okay. A ton is a Honda Civic. That's a ton. Okay. 15. So these fleets go out and they acquire gold for Solomon. So he's got armies. He's got fortified cities. He's got ships. I mean, can you see the reach that this guy has? Nobody's had this before, not like Solomon. Yeah.
God blessed Solomon with all of that stuff, though. He didn't ask for it, knowing that this would ultimately be his demise. Why is that?
Solomon's heart is his demise. So God gives this to him, but his heart goes south. And that's not on God, that's on Solomon. So to Solomon's credit, he lasts a lot longer than I would have. Right? I mean, he's able to administrate and be godly and not get sucked into the vortex. But boy, I just don't know anybody. Guys, remember that. Difficulty is not the problem. Prosperity is the problem. Difficulty makes us go, oh gosh, I have nothing. I'm an idiot. I need to go to God. Prosperity, we go, I don't need God. I have everything. I can pay the bills. I got a car. I got a house. I got a second house. I got, and I don't need you. Thank you very much. Most people can get through difficulty. They cling to God and realize they are nothing. Some point in the journey to prosperity, our hearts change and we realize, I don't need God, or we think that. It's just a matter of when. So as God blesses you, remember that. There's nothing wrong with blessing. Keep your heart right, okay? And I'm convinced that the people that God blesses maybe not solely, the people that God wants to bless financially are the ones that can handle that and are steward well and give and don't get consumed by stuff and think that stuff somehow matters. Okay, so if God does that to you one day, good. Okay, cut a check to Elliott's Church. You know, be generous. Do you know, support missionaries, support your local nonprofits. You know, do all that. Okay, all right, there you go. Now, chapter 10, Queen of Sheba. This gal is from, where is this place? Sabaeans in Arabia is where this gal is from. She comes in to see Solomon because she's heard of his reputation. Ryan, what were you going to say? Note in my Bible says Southern Arabia, East Africa, or India. So apparently they are not exactly sure where. So take your pick. Throw a dart at a map. That's where it is. So far away is the idea. So people are coming in from Solomon's sending people out far, and they're coming in from far away as well. Okay, Queen of Sheba, who apparently is a big deal, comes in, verse 10, chapter 1 of verse 10, asks Solomon everything she can think of, right? Difficult questions, it says. Solomon in verse 3 answered all her questions. Nothing was hidden from the king, which he did not explain to her. So this isn't some politicking, like smooth talking, whatever. She asks him difficult stuff, and he gives her amazing answers. She is blown away. Verse 6, this is her report of King Solomon. This is a gal that is not on Solomon's team. This is an independent, you know, non-biased third party. Reads 10, verse 6. Good,
you exceed in wisdom and prosperity the report which I heard.
How about that? Like, I heard you were bad. I didn't even think that was true. I got here and wow, you are beyond what I even heard. And you were Paul Bunyan in my dreams. And then I got here and realized that didn't even begin to describe. You guys know who Paul Bunyan is? Y'all need to get edumacated. Anyway, yes, the big ox. Thank you, people. They're more seasoned vintage. All right. So, anyway. All right. So, that's Paul Bunyan. We'll talk about him in a second. No, we won't. We'll talk about these kings in a second. So, just so you guys get an idea, people are mesmerized at this guy's wisdom, money, administration of lands. I mean, it's crazy, okay? How blessed you are to men, your servants. You're great to your people, she says in verse 9. Blessed be your God. She gave in verse 10 the king 120 talents of gold. So just Solomon gets his socks blessed off. Now, put on your Jewish lenses for a second. Look at chapter 10, verse 14. Why would this be mentioned?
Now,
25 tons of gold. That was his, like, that's his allowance every year. That's what he gets paid. Okay. If you're reading with Hebrew eyes, what sticks out at you? 666. Why 666? If you're reading Hebrew, their first question isn't how much is 666 talents? Oh, it's 25 tons. Oh, that's a lot. They think, 666, and we know this, is a sign of what? You go, evil. Something's going on. So there's some speculations that the reason that that number specifically is mentioned is you go, huh, something's going awry, and it's about to turn south. There's too much. Solomon can't handle this, okay? Verse 18, the guy has a throne made of ivory, a solid ivory throne to sit on, okay? So there really is such thing as an ivory throne, by the way, not just Elvis, okay? 21, you talk about the downside of this. All of King Solomon's drinking vessels were gold. All of the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were gold. None was of silver. It was considered valuable. It was not. I knew there was a not. It was not considered valuable in the days of Solomon. So silver was like trash. It's, you talk about overinflation. Solomon has caused a problem in his kingdom because of too much of a good thing. All right. So though it's great and though it looks good, we've got issues. Okay. Verse 24, all the earth was seeking the presence of Solomon. Everything's wonderful, okay, until chapter 11. By the way, 1027, the king made silver as common as stones in Jerusalem. That's like saying as common as dust in Fresno. Like, it's everywhere. And you just disregarded it. Like, man. So, 11 verse 1, okay, we've seen the signs of it going south. Now it's going to really start going south. Somebody pick up there, 11 verse 1. Right, which all worship different gods, right? And he's got a grip of them from every place. Keep rolling.
From the nations concerning which the Lord has said to the sons of Israel, you shall not associate with them, nor shall they associate with you. For they will surely turn their heart away after their gods.
Okay. Every time God speaks of multiple wives, what is the core issue? This one right here. It's about idolatry. They will turn your hearts away. Now, if your women want to punt their God and be like Ruth and worship Yahweh and say, where you go, I go, your people, my people, my God, your God will be my God, green light, no problem. Marry whoever you want, right? No issues. But if they're not willing to repent of their gods and their idols, Solomon ain't going to work. It hasn't worked in all of human history. Your hearts will get turned away. There's one of you and 1,000 of them. You're not going to win that battle, okay? Verse 3, here's where we get the number. 700 wives, 300 concubines, and his wives turn his heart away. This is the downfall of Solomon. So as you think about Solomon's kingdom, what was the ultimate issue of his downfall? In a word. Starts with an I and ends with idolatry. Idolatry is the issue. Solomon did not worship God fully. Now, God's desire was not for him to have 1,000 wives. Could God have lived with it? I think so. Did God want Solomon to have 666 talents of gold as an allowance every year? Probably not. Could he have lived with it? Yeah, if his heart would have remained pure. The straw that breaks the camel's back every time is idolatry. And because of this statement right here, Solomon's heart finally cracks. The teeter-totter tips. He breaks. Okay, this isn't, again, as Scott rightly mentioned, this doesn't happen overnight. It's decision after decision after decision that causes this to go south, and he's done. Okay? So, watch what he does. Verse 4.
When Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been.
Notice the measuring rod is David, right? A pure heart. David had lots of issues, but man, at the end of the day, he worships God and God alone. You do not see in David's career ever him worshiping idols, ever, okay? Lots of other issues, but not that one, okay? Solomon, verse 5, went after, keep reading, Ryan.
For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites. Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not follow the Lord fully as David his father had done. And Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable idol of Moab, on a mountain which is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the detestable idol of the sons of Ammon.
Molech and Chemosh. Who were they? The child sacrifice idols. Where does he build those? Right across the street from the temple. Mount of Olives area. Okay, the mountain east of the temple is Mount of Olives. So he puts up pagan altars that you would offer child sacrifices upon, for these two gods and the rest of them. I mean, these are, you talk about the 8, 9s, and 10s of the filthy, McNasty gods. There are none worse. That's them. Chemosh and Molech are the worst of the worst in terms of what they're, what they required, if you will, if they were such a true thing, okay, or a real thing. So, oddly enough, God is a little bit angry. Lord was angry with Solomon, verse 9, because his heart was turned away. And God basically says, Solomon, we're done. You could have had infinite blessing, okay? But he says, because of this, because you went after other gods, in verse 10, verse 11, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have surely commanded you, I will tear the kingdom from you and give it to your servant. So you're going to get the kingdom split from you. However, verse 13, I will not tear it away. I will not tear away all the kingdom. I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. I promise David an everlasting covenant that one of your members will be on the throne forever. Okay, Solomon's son is going to get that. It's not going to go south during Solomon's time. It's going to go south during his son's reign. Okay, what is Solomon's son's name? You guys remember? Rehoboam is the guy. Okay, this kingdom is about to split. Okay, so back up here, way back up to our chart. Saul, David, Solomon, they all reigned for how long? 40 years. The kingdom splits 40 years into Solomon's reign and his death in 931. Now the kingdom is never going to be united again. It's going to split. Israel to the north. Okay, notice all the evil kings here. We've talked about this before. And then Judah to the south. Rehoboam is going to be the first king of Judah. And it's a mixed bag. Some good, some bad. Mostly bad, but a few kings that are at least a bright spot on the radar. This is where the kingly line will come from. This is where Jesus will trace his lineage. Okay, the northern tribes get 10 tribes, right? In the south with Judah, you get Judah and Benjamin, who's encapsulated within Big Brother Judah. Okay, so two tribes to the south, 10 to the north. The tribe of Levi is not necessarily a part of this, but all the tribes in the north are evil. Rehoboam, Solomon's son, will be the first king here. Jeroboam, who's the servant that we just talked about, is the first king in the north, okay? Jeroboam, our story we're about to read, is Solomon's, he's one of the guys on Solomon's team. And God says, I'm going to rip the kingdom out of Solomon's hand, and I'm going to give it to your servant Jeroboam, okay? Jeroboam is also a goofball. Rehoboam is probably, as Brad would say, the stupidest guy in your entire Bible, okay? That's Brad's description of Rehoboam, which I think is fairly accurate. He says one, Benjamin kind of gets sucked in with Judah. So Judah is the one that they focus on because Benjamin is just geographically down south and surrounded by Judah. They get sucked in as well. Okay, so we'll see mentioned 10 in the north and then one in the south. But that's kind of the idea. All right. Make sense? So we're about to enter a period in Kings where you're going to get a fire hydrant full of names. Don't sweat it. I want you guys to see the big picture. Okay. Kingdom splits in 931. The first two kings are important. The lines are important. Okay. Some of the names I'll mention are important. Okay. Don't sweat it. I want you guys to see the pegboard. Okay. So that later on you can fill in the pegs. All right. This takes a long time to learn. It's not taught very often. There are gold mines of stories and stuff that happens in here that are great. Okay. But just, I want you guys to see the flow of human history. Okay. The beautiful thing about the Bible is it never changes. So you can go back to it, study it again, right? So God promises Solomon, you're done because of your wicked, idolatrous heart. You're done. Idolatry is what led to the downfall of the nation. Idolatry is not going to leave because of Solomon through the reign of all these kings, and we're not going to finally see it dealt with until the days of Nehemiah, okay? So we're talking 500 plus years into the future, and even as we go to see all the ruins in Israel, idolatry is the thing that continues to mark site after site after site. It was just this mixed bag of half-hearted worship of God. Okay, so, all right. So, chapter 11, verse 14, God begins to raise up adversaries to Solomon. Okay, two of these guys are unimportant in terms of our, story, if you will. 14, the Lord raised up an adversary to Solomon, Hadad, the Edomite. Okay, so this guy is going to be an issue for Solomon. Verse 23, there's another guy, Rezon, okay, also not important. Third guy is mentioned in verse 26. Here's the guy that we've been talking about, Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. This is going to be the first king of the northern tribe. So as God splits the kingdom again, this is the guy that's going to take his place. Verse 28, this is the story of Jeroboam. Here's who he is to Solomon. 11:28.
The man of Jeroboam was very evil. And when Solomon saw that the young man was industrious, he gave him charge over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. All
right, so he's in charge of the forced labor of everyone on the east side of the Jordan, Manasseh and Ephraim, okay? Not the slaves, but the forced labor from Israel, okay? So he's a guy that Solomon trusts, he knows. Okay, God comes to him in verse 31 and says, hey, Jeroboam, I'm mad at Solomon. I'm giving you a portion of the kingdom. verse 31, through this prophet, God says, take for yourselves 10 pieces, i.e. 10 tribes. Behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and give you 10 tribes. So that is promised through the mouth of a prophet of God to Jeroboam. And he says, great. And he says in verse 34, however, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand. Okay, you get 10, you don't get 12. I'm going to give, verse 34, nevertheless, I will not take the hand, take the whole kingdom out of his hand. I will make him ruler the days of my life for the sake of my servant David, whom I chose, who observed the commandments of my statutes. Verse 36, to his son, I will give one tribe. My servant David may have a lamp always before me in Jerusalem. So David's son, Rehoboam, Solomon's son, Rehoboam, is going to be the guy that gets the small little wick, if you will, the last little burning candle of the hope of Israel. So Jeroboam says, or gets told, you get 10, you don't get 12, okay? He's going to be a chump and try to take them all. Surprise, surprise. And Solomon's son is promised one tribe, which obviously now includes Benjamin, so he gets two, all right? Makes sense? So that's what's coming. Kingdom's about to split. Verse 40, Solomon finds out about this, and how do you think he's going to feel about it? Yeah, ticked. So here's his response. Verse 40, rather. 11:40.
Solomon sought, therefore, to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam arose and fled into Egypt to Shishak, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon.
All right, so Jeroboam finds out that his life's at stake. He flees to Egypt, and he stays there until verse 41 when Solomon dies. Okay, Solomon dies, and Jeroboam comes back. Okay, so now we've got a dead king of the United Monarchy. We got God's promises that are about to come true. 12 verse 1, watch what happens. Here is Solomon's son, Rehoboam.
Then Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king.
Okay, so Shechem is going to be it's going to become a place of power yet again. We've seen this city a gazillion times. It's going to be for the northern tribes, kind of their central focus. So Jerusalem is going to be the capital of Judah in the south. Shechem is going to become the place of power, or the capital, if you will, for the northern tribes, because they obviously have to have a different home base. Okay, so right now you've got Rehoboam is trying to figure out, dude, my dad's dead. I got a really angry country. I need to unite them or they're all going to split. Okay, keep going. Okay, so he comes back. They called and sent him. Jeroboam, all the assembly spoke to Israel and spoke to Rehoboam. So Jeroboam's job currently, or was before he got fired and ran to Egypt, was over the forced labor in Israel. Okay, the nation comes to Rehoboam, and this is the request that they make. Look at verse 4. Notice what they say about Solomon, how he treated the people. So this is the whole nation, okay? What do they say? Loved your dad. However, we had one beef. What was that beef? Dude, he whipped us. He worked us so hard. If you will simply lighten the load, we'll follow you. The entire nation says, we will follow you, okay? So Rehoboam says, you know what? Give me 3 days, okay? Let me think about it. King Rehoboam, in verse 6, consulted with the elders who had served with his father. Good call? Yeah, let's consult the older, wise, seasoned men. What do you all think about what these people said? So he asked him. So that's good. You've got some of your daddy's genes in you. You're wise. So they spoke to him, and this is what they say in verse 7. Elliot, read that. So what's their advice? Listen to the people. Lighten their load. Do what they've asked, and they're going to love you, okay? Is that good counsel? It's great counsel, okay? The problem is this guy's an idiot. He forsook the counsel of the elders, which they had given him, and consulted with the young men. He grabs a bunch of younger guys that are prideful, want to beat their chest. Rehoboam, you need to make a statement. You need to be the next king. You need to be a big deal, right? They placate to his pride. And they said, what counsel do you give? And boy, this is some of the funniest text in your Bible. He said to them, what counsel do you give me? The people said, lighten the yoke. The young men in verse 10 say, thus you shall say to the people who spoke to you, your father made our yoke heavy. Now make it lighter for us. But you shall speak to them, in verse 10, my little finger is thicker than my father's loins. That means exactly what you think it means. That is a male locker room inappropriate joke. If you think my dad, how do I make this PG? If you think my dad was well endowed, I am the biggest deal on the block. And that's basically what he's saying. So if you think my dad treated you harshly, wait till you see what I do. Can you see the advice that he got from the younger men? Okay, this would be a very different conversation if it was a room full of men. Okay, so take it for what it is. This is a young, prideful guy that says, man, I am going to make a statement. He is dumb. All he had to do was listen to the people. We would never have a divided monarchy. We would have a united monarchy, and we would see, but he doesn't because he's dumb. And God said, I'm going to strip it away. Probably in his 20s, same as Solomon. I don't know the exact age, but young. Solomon only reigns for 40 years, so this guy can't be super old, okay? Verse 11, here he goes. My father loaded you with a heavy yoke. I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips. I will discipline you with scorpions. If you think it was hard under him, you haven't seen nothing. That's what he's speaking. So you can imagine what the country's response is going to be, okay? They came to Jeroboam and they said, hey, we asked Rehoboam to lighten the load. Basically, in a nutshell, Rehoboam said, heck no. So in verse 16, Rehoboam now unites the northern kingdom, and this is their response to Rehoboam, his son, Solomon's son, about trying to unite the kingdom. Verse 16, they say, what portion do we have with David? What inheritance do we have with the son of Jesse? Meaning, what do we have to do with Judah? Okay, those southern tribes, we want nothing to do with you, Judah. We're going to go north. We're going to split. We're going to take Jeroboam, our boy, with us, who's not going to whip us like your father and like Rehoboam promised. We're going to go north. So now the split occurs in the kingdom. These guys follow Jeroboam, the 10 tribes in the north, and now Rehoboam gets exactly what he deserved, which was actually not what he deserved. He got more than he deserved. He became ruler over the southern portion, and Jeroboam takes now the north, okay? So, make sense?
Why would anybody want to stay with Rehoboam? I guess because they're assigned to
they're loyal to David because of his line, but yeah, he's a dingbat. And part of it's just geography. Like, you're stuck where you're stuck. So, okay? So, now, Rehoboam now makes another really stupid move in verse 18. Verse 17, the sons of Israel who lived in the cities of Judah, Rehoboam reigned over them. And then 18, watch who Rehoboam is going to send as a representative of his to the northern tribes.
Then King Rehoboam sent Adoram, who was over the forced labor, and all Israel stoned him to death.
So you're going to go send a mouthpiece to Israel to try to make peace, and who do you send? The guy that's been whipping you since David's day. I mean, boy, you're dumb, right? There's nobody worse you could have picked. Pick somebody that's happy and gregarious and hasn't whipped anybody, right? He sends the guy who was in charge of the forced labor. The reason they split was what? Because how your dad handled things with forced labor and how you promised to do the same. So he sends the guy with the forced labor. What do you think they're going to say? Get out of here. So they stone him. So just the guy is prideful and dumb. So as a result, verse 21, we now have a civil war. Judah and the tribe of Benjamin brings 180,000 men. So there's your note, by the way, in verse 21. Judah and Benjamin in the south bring 180,000 men with Rehoboam. They're going to go head-to-head now with Jeroboam. So now we're going to have what we haven't seen since the days of literally the judges, when we're going to have a civil war within Israel. And now in verse 23, the word of God comes through a man of God. 23, this is what he says to Rehoboam. Pick up in 12:23. What does that mean? Why does God say, Rehoboam, you may not go fight Jeroboam? Not only that, but what did God say? What did he promise Jeroboam? I already gave him the tribes. It's done. And fighting ain't going to fix it. I've already done it. So go home, and they go home. Okay? So now we've got a split in the kingdom. It's done. It's finished. Like it or not, that's where we're at. You've got Rehoboam in the south, Solomon's son, Jeroboam in the north over the 10 tribes, Solomon's old labor enforcer of the tribes of Israel. Okay? Jessica, do you have a thought? Nope. Okay. All right. Let's finish the story here of Jeroboam in chapter 12, verse 25, and watch what he does.
Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there.
Okay, so this is now going to be the northern capital. So Shechem, who we've seen all the way, or that town we've seen all the way since Abraham's day in Genesis, is going to become the northern capital. So you got Jerusalem in the south, Shechem in the north, okay? Now, Jeroboam realizes something, okay? This is smart. 28, or 26 rather.
Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom will return to the house of David. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will return to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will flee and return to Rehoboam.
All right, so here's the issue. Scott, you were asking about this later, or earlier. They're still worshiping God, kind of, in the land. Where is the proper place of worship in Israel? Jerusalem. So when the Exodus commands are obeyed and they have to go back to Jerusalem to worship God for Passover, for Sukkot, and those holidays, all of my people are going to go down to Jerusalem. And then what's going to happen? Where's Jerusalem in terms of what is Jerusalem now to Jeroboam, friend or foe? Foe. So I can't possibly let them go down and worship in Jerusalem. So what would you do? I'm going to make my own. Okay, here's what he does. 28, the king consulted and made two golden calves. How about that? All the way back to our Exodus days. We are 500 years past that. They're going to make two golden calves and said, it's too much for you to go to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that you brought from the land of Egypt. This is what provided for you. He set up one in Bethel and the other in Dan. Now, you know where Dan is. Where's Dan? All the way north. And where would you guess Bethel is? The southern end of his land. So he sets up easy access to worship. Okay? You've got a calf in the north, a calf in the south. You have no need to go to Jerusalem. So this guy, where Rehoboam is an idiot and could have united the kingdom, this guy is known for idolatry. Okay? He starts a whole nother level of false worship. Within his new boundaries, Bethel is the furthest south that he can go before he gets into Judah, and Dan is still the furthest north. So he wanted to create easy access for everybody. He's got the largest landmass north to south. So he's like, great, I'll set up north or south, wherever you guys want to go. You've got places to go worship. That's the capital. So he's going to rule from there, but no calves there. Okay, so he sets them up in the north and the south. We will visit Dan when we go to Israel. We'll see the altar that was built by Jeroboam that was there that a king's going to tear down later on. But that's what they start. Yeah, Buck.
Isn't this where in coming out from Exodus, Moses ground them up and made them eat it?
The calves? Yes, it's not
in. Grab your swords.
Yes, was that at Shechem? No, that was at the foot of Mount Sinai.
When they were wandering?
Yes, it was when they were wandering. So at the foot of Mount Sinai. But yeah, so but they're going all the way back to the same idols that they worship coming out of Egypt. So okay, more on that tomorrow, 7:30. You guys enjoy the rest of your day. Yes, ma'am. With Levi, yeah, there's always been 13. So it's Levi's the issue. So there's 13 tribes, they just don't count Levi because they don't have any land. So yeah, Simeon's still in there.
says he consulted. It's like, who's giving this guy advice to end up with calves?
Yeah. His cabinet, I'm sure. Just stupid guys that are as dumb as he is. So.